Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Segment of our show, we'll hear from Karen O'Neill, who'll be telling us a little bit about the Paralympic Committee's preparation for the upcoming Games. So tell me a little bit about the recent work of the Paralympic Committee.
Well, the Canadian Paralympic Committee is comprised of about 25 members, Cam, and they're all national sport organizations. And so a good example is our work heading into the Pyeongchang Winter Paralympic Games. And our primary focus is to field and support Team Canada. Obviously, our member sport organizations, in this case five of them, are working directly with the athletes and coaches for the remainder of the 355 days a year. But when it comes to games time, we're the ones that will be organizing what in essence is a big road trip and a world-class platform for so many of our athletes to compete with the world's best. So I would say that's our primary occupation and focus right now. I would say that other things that we do outside of the games are really promoting and supporting a sustainable parasport system. For us, as much as we focus on the games and fielding and supporting Team Canada for their very best performance, we are also deeply focused on ensuring that the results are sustaining and that we have a system that is embedded across the country, across our provinces and territories, meaning that they are all comfortable places that in sport and physical activity that there's accessible, inclusive, and available opportunities for persons with a disability to participate.
So, when you talk about accessible opportunities, what sorts of features do you tend to look for in defining this?
Well, that's a great question because accessibility spans so many different areas. A few examples for us, Cam, would include things like at the very basic level, accessible facilities. And oftentimes when you have a rink or a facility that's already been pre-built, oftentimes the first question will be if a club is coming in and wanting to provide and support programs, then it's a question about how do we modify or adapt? How can you help support us or direct us to the right resources so that, in fact, this facility, this field, this swimming pool is accessible? I would also say from a program standpoint, we have so many of our sport organizations and physical activity and recreation at a local club level, at a city and municipal level, at a provincial territorial level, and at a national level. And it's really looking at, with the provision of services, that we really focus on the needs and interests of the participants throughout that whole process of what we would call an athlete or participant pathway. So whether that mean the opportunities in any of the selection of sport and physical activity that people would know about the opportunities to get involved, people would be able to know where to get involved, what it would mean to get involved, and that there would be really appropriate support. So once they join the program, that there's quality coaching or leadership that understands the needs and interests of the individual, and that can also modify the participation opportunity to meet their needs. So I would say those are a few examples. whether it be the architectural and physical accessibility, the program and service accessibility, which is really, you know, built upon the needs and interests of the participants throughout all stages of engagement, whether that be at the local recreation physic activity level, all the way up to the provincial and national level where you've got a competitive world-class performance. So those are just a few examples.
So are there any challenges in working with the local facilities to provide fully accessible opportunities?
Well, you know what, as much as there's challenges, what I would say, Cam, is I think we're all witnessing an openness and a readiness of individuals, particularly at local and provincial levels, and even at national levels, to look at how they can make their programs, their services, their facilities accessible and inclusive and available. And I would say that before, even probably 5-6 years ago, Cam, the bigger issue for us was the awareness and education, so that people and individuals and facilities in key leadership roles would understand that there's work to be done and it requires their leadership. And I would say in a very short time that commitment of some of the key leadership roles at those levels is dramatically different in a very good way and supportive. So the next challenge I would say is some of the most common barriers that we see are whether it be accessibility to facilities and what does that take in terms of the understanding, the knowledge, or the cost to retrofit. Sometimes it would be access to appropriate equipment. Oftentimes what we like to do, and particularly at some of the introduction to physical activity and physical literacy, we'll try to look at supporting programs that oftentimes are not equipment dependent, so that accessibility would not be a barrier. But in some areas where equipment would be required, like a wheelchair basketball or wheelchair rugby, so many of our partners have See It, Try It programs, like the Canadian Wheelchair Sport Association and Bridging the Gap program, or at the provincial level, so many great examples of come, see it, try it, and that there's equipment available there, or equipment loaner programs to the various clubs, schools, and municipalities to, number one, gauge interest for them to have the equipment, so cost for equipment's not a barrier, and then to also looking at linking ongoing for how they could implement the programs ongoing. So I would say facility access and equipment are probably two of the biggest areas, and it's more the resources and capacity to ensure that opportunities are available.
So on the converse side of things, mm-hmm. in your time with the committee, has there been any success story that stands out for you? Maybe an athlete who performed above and beyond?
Do you know, I would say absolutely, and I would say the examples would be many. More and more we've been working in close cooperation, not only with our national sport partners, but also our provincial partners. And I can't get over how many young and up-and-coming participants who have, let's say, come to one of our talent recruitment days who just didn't know what the options were. So number one, they have the opportunity to meet some of our current Paralympians and find out about their journey, about what they did, and be inspired by some of the role models, and then also to be connected with some of the coaches and leadership at the local level, so at least they know the pathway, they know how to get involved. And I would say that I would be into double-digit examples even in this year alone, Cam, for how many of those young up-and-coming participants we've been able to, with our partners at the provincial level, the sport, physical activity, and national level, have been able to find where the opportunities are, connect with some of the athletes who've been sharing their stories so they know what's possible.
So what can you tell me about the upcoming games?
Well, pretty exciting. The games are going to be held in Pyeongchang, South Korea, March 9th to 18th. Team Canada is fielding a team of approximately 116 overall, of which there's 52 athletes competing in five sports: para-alpine skiing, para-ice hockey, wheelchair curling, biathlon, across country skiing, and para snowboard. Preparation is underway. It'll be available for everybody to see through a really dynamic broadcast program. So partnering with CBC, Radio-Canada, and AMI, there'll be several hundreds of hours of coverage, starting with opening ceremonies live on March 9th. So I hope everybody will join us in supporting our Team Canada athletes. And you can also track our progress and find out a little bit more about Team Canada and our athletes by going to www.paralympic.ca.
Thank you very much. The Paralympics. You could regard it as the world stage for people with disabilities, a chance to get out there and showcase their athletic abilities. What I find is all too common among athletes, especially those with an acquired disability. They might labor under the false notion that it's the end for them, their game is over. But an event like this can prove just the opposite. There's still athletic skill, performance, precision, power goes into this competition. That an athlete need not be limited by what you might call a physical barrier. You want to do something in this world, you go out, you find the right adaptation, you do it. Athletes with disabilities, they have what you might call that sense of freedom. When they're out there doing their game, just being a part of it, playing with the team, listening to the cheer of the crowd, it's a very freeing experience. For the fact is, you look out into the crowd, they're cheering, they don't care that at one time you walked, quote, normally, or that you were in a car accident or what have you. They just care that you're a great athlete out there to play a great game. And they enjoy it just as much. Tragedy, though, is that the Paralympics don't seem to get the same level of press that the Olympics do. These athletes, they give it their all, and they put on a fantastic show. Truth is, we should all just take a moment to recognize that regardless of how an athlete plays the game, they play it well, and they give it their all. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Peer Support Center is here to remind students that they are not alone. Most students are experiencing university life for the first time, but can also bring levels of anxiety, financial strain, and loneliness. Professional help is available to all students 24 hours a day. They are also available on a drop-in basis from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. The center is located in room 208 of the Cost Student Center, and for more information, please call 519-253-3000, extension 4551, or email psc@uwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Karen O'Neill from the Paralympic Committee. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Bonnie Brayton from the Disabled Women's Network. So tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with Dawn.
Well, thanks, Cam. It's good to talk to you, and nice to get a chance to connect with you and your listeners in terms of what we've been up to. I think you and I have talked in the past about a project Dawn Canada has been doing called Legislation, Policy, and Service Responses to Violence Against Women with Disabilities in Canada. In fact, I can remember you were one of the first people to interview me when we launched the project about 2 years ago. And so over the last 2 years, we've been looking at legislation and policy in Quebec, Ontario, and British Columbia specifically in terms of what the funding allowed us to do. And, of course, what came out of that will not surprise some people, but certainly is a huge indicator in terms of what we need to address in Canada in terms of women with disabilities and violence, which is that what we found is that women with disabilities across a number of policies were being, I would say the only way I could explain it would be that women with disabilities are being ungendered in policy. So, examples of that would be that you have a list of women's experiences of violence, and you know, there's a list where they're talking about Indigenous women, immigrant women, LGBTQ women, and then instead of saying "and women with disabilities," the list would go on to say "and people with disabilities." And to be really clear, Cam, we understand at Dawn Canada that the rates of violence against people with disabilities, including men, are higher than they are in the non-disabled population. But as a fundamental principle around receiving proper services and responses for women and girls with disabilities, our ungendering in violence against women policy is one of the very clear reasons why there are no service responses that are directly focused on women and girls with disabilities. And in fact, you know, what we found is that there isn't a single resource in the country that is specifically devoted to women with disabilities. While many of the transitioners houses and shelters do offer and support accommodation, I think the fact that there is no focal point other than the work that Dawn Canada is doing points to why this gap exists. And it's, of course, out of that footnoting in policy that we found that we've come up with a campaign we have that we launched in December called More Than a Footnote. And in terms of our first event, we held an event in Ottawa in December where we invited women with disabilities leaders to a national roundtable. And at the roundtable, what we did was really unpack the research a bit and then looked for recommendations. And so some of the things that really emerged clearly in terms of the kind of things that women with disabilities and deaf women have said through the More Than a Footnote campaign is that the policies about violence against women with disabilities are not mentioning women specifically, and in some provinces, they're merely added as a footnote, and as a result, women with disabilities are not getting the services they need. And so our call to action invites people to join through the following email address, More Than a Footnote, just the way it sounds, MoreThanAFootnote, More Than a Footnote, all one word, at dawncanada.net. I certainly hope some of the folks listening will think to join the campaign. How it will work is we will have regular calls to action for all the folks who subscribe to the More Than a Footnote campaign. And, you know, we're going to be doing those on a monthly basis across the different regions. We did a wonderful campaign in British Columbia. We expect to be doing one in Quebec in, I think it's in March, and in Ontario in April. So in terms of one of the other things that I think comes out of this is that programs and policies related to gender-based violence tend to name us also as a vulnerable group in preamble and then footnoting us into vulnerable groups, but without really, again, a shift from recognizing us as a vulnerable group to pointing to policy or to policy responses that need to be made. And of course, that separation of women with disabilities has left us a footnote in the minds of policymakers.
So, in terms of these incidents of violence,
yes,
with the recent climate being what it is, with all the media stuff, do you find that a woman with a disability might be more hesitant to talk about such an incident?
Yes, I think that's a really important point to make too, Cam, of course, is that we know from the data that has been, you know, repeatedly shared over years that the rates of violence against women with disabilities and girls with disabilities is higher, but that they're being supported and given the space to come forward with their abuse stories has been really a challenge. And I don't think that there's any reason to think that based on the fact that the More Than a Footnote campaign reveals the lack of services, including the kind of services that would be really important to think about in the context of a woman with a disability and the kind of barrier she has to reporting, is that we really need to address that first and foremost, is that there is, again, with that lack of services, no place for her to go to be supported, to disclose, and that absence in terms of something that feels like it's for her, directed at her, as opposed to her having to, you know, potentially negotiate the barriers of access, of transportation, and or communication, her concerns over the fact that if she discloses, she may lose her support. You know, in some cases with women with disabilities, of course, we know that it's it's unfortunately people who are close to her, so we're talking about caregivers, people in transportation, those sorts of issues that are much more specific to women with disabilities that leave her in a place where disclosure and access to disclosure is either difficult, impossible, or places her at risk.
So, in that sense, if you could send any message to anyone out there who might be experiencing some of these issues, what would you say?
Well, I would say that if there is a women-serving organization in your community, that's a place to start, but if you don't feel that you have access, that you can contact On Canada, and we will do our best to refer you to a service in your area where you will be supported. And certainly what I want most of all for women and girls with disabilities to hear is you will be believed, you're supported by law in terms of your right to disclose and your right to access your right to services and to the supports you need to be moved to a safe environment if where you are isn't safe. It's also really important for women and girls with disabilities to understand that having a safety plan is a really important way to take that step, and that having a safety plan in place is the first thing to think about. And again, many transition houses and shelters have secure services where you can contact them and, again, discuss your needs and let them help you to develop a safety plan. But the first and most important thing to do is to understand you will be supported, you will be believed, we will work with you and find you the services and supports you need.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
No problem, Cam. Thanks.
In this next segment of our show, our favorite able-bodied observer, Samantha Newmarch, will be talking about accessible features in the housing market. So in your experiences with real estate, can you tell me a little bit about some of the accessible features you've seen or things you'd like to see improved on some of the houses on the market?
Absolutely. So as of late, DMHC has designated a universal design for all new houses. That being said, there are still a lot of roadblocks in the way of accessibility within Ontario, specifically a universal design. So when I say universal design, what I mean is that we are now planning living spaces for the location of rooms, open planning, general space planning, so that houses are now more accessible to those who need accessibility measures. So wider door openings, wider hallways, so that there's a clear path of travel and turn spaces for, you know, those who need it.
So in terms of older houses that may go up on the market, do you find they're generally well suited to adaptation for this design?
I feel as though they are suited for adaptation, but that being said, a lot of the older houses do require extensive and expensive renovations. That being said, as a realtor in Toronto and as an interior decorator and designer, I'm able to further help people with accessibility issues to further suit their needs. And so if we go into a house that the buyer is looking to buy but has accessibility issues, what I'm able to do is, you know, widen the doorways for them or bring an electrician in so that we can bring the light switches down so that it's more accessible to their needs.
So in general terms, then, you make accessibility a priority when a client needs it.
Absolutely. So my biggest priority is working in the best interest of my client. And so with my side business, Madeline Design, what I'm able to do is walk them through the house, and if there is any issue that pertains to what they need in terms of accessibility, what I'm able to do is bring in my team and solve any issue that may be standing in their way.
So when you work with solving the issues, do you have any partnerships that have proven especially helpful in taking care of some of these issues?
Absolutely. So Madeline Design works with a team of carpenters, electricians, plumbers, who I'm able to contact at any time and bring them in to solve any kind of accessibility issue that my client may be looking at.
So is there any example that stands out for you of when you were able to help a client and the design worked out especially well?
So I've worked with a few elderly clients, and their main issues were, you know, narrow hallways, or, you know, they have limited accessibility, and so they're not able to bring up their arms to reach the panels or the electrical switches. And so what I was able to do is bring down the electrical switches to further facilitate their needs.
From a design standpoint, why do you think it's important to keep people with disabilities in mind when things are being put together in the first place?
Just so that the home that they're living in, their general living space, is accessible to them, not just accessible to people with able bodies, but accessible to their needs. And it's so important to take that into consideration, because, you know, you shouldn't have to walk into a house and have limited accessibility. You should walk into a house and be able to make it your home and comfortable in accordance with your needs.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. My friends, it's a great pleasure to have Sam back on the show. Here we have someone who's always cared about inclusivity, always cared about such things. When I first met her, she shared a very simple story of respecting someone's right to access at school, and that really struck me. Because you can look at things like wheelchair buttons and letting people through in one of two ways. You can see it as just common courtesy, or you can go below the surface and say, I respect your right to access. And this is especially important in terms of design. When you have a place that's built, think about it. At some point, a person with a disability is going to want to come in there, whether it be a home or a business. What have you. People with disabilities should have as much right to access as anyone else. Fact is, especially from a business standpoint, it's only shortchanging yourself if you don't take that into consideration. Now, Sam was right that some of the options for upgrades, for accessibility, those can get pretty expensive. But there's got to be some option. There's got to be something that can be taken in just to alleviate the pressure, especially with an aging population. People acquire disabilities with age in a lot of cases. Fact is, a person who's lived in one place all their life isn't going to want to leave it simply because their mobility situation has to be adjusted. The fact that there are options, the fact that Sam is working with designers to make these things possible, really struck me as an amazing body of work. It's one thing to say, this is what we have, live in it or don't. It's another to say, we have this available. Now, this might be a challenge, but what we're going to do is, we're going to work with you. We're going to make it possible for you. That shows a genuine respect and consideration for people with disabilities. I always say, there's always an adaptation. There's always an option. The fact that someone of such skill would actually partner with some of the great minds available, the great designers, to make it work, that's really a gift to people with disabilities, because they, like anyone else, go looking for service, go looking for the best quality they can find. And if they find someone who takes their needs and their design requirements into consideration, odds are it'll establish a good business relationship. It's been proven time and again that people with disabilities just want the same consideration anyone else does. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.